Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 19th, 2005. This session, City of God, Where We Live and God's Creation. Alternatives, What Then Shall We Do? Presented by Will Schroer in the Fireside Room. Disc number SCW-2005-05. Let's listen in.
Project City of God is the published one, and then on the way here I decided to change the title to City Blank God, and the idea is that we should think about what the correct relationship between those two things is, if we were going to in fact say it should be City of God, then what would that city look like? I see a bunch of returnees, so that's why I'm going to skip through some of the preliminaries very quickly here. This is the place where, when I do this professionally, I explain where I'm from and what all the degrees I have, and therefore why you should listen to me. But it's my contention that most of the qualifications that one needs to think intelligently about city design and planning are not academic, but rather come out of who we are and what we're about. And so I suggest that you have just as many qualifications in this field as I do, which is a good thing because we're the only people out there that ultimately are going to be able to select our destiny. So keep those your qualifications in mind to participate in this planning process as we move forward. The other two big questions I've been putting up at the beginning of every session, encouraging people to think about them, are whether Christianity is pro or anti-place, broadly speaking, and then a subsection of that, is it pro or anti-city? And much of my thinking on this subject has actually been formed by this book, which is in the bookstore, which I cannot recommend highly enough, Sidewalks in the Kingdom, New Urbanism and the Christian Faith by Eric Jacobson, who is a pastor in Missoula, Montana, and has no training in planning or urbanism whatsoever, but became interested in the subject just in the course of his duties as a pastor, noticing how the design of different parts of Missoula impacted his life and that of his parishioners. And he tees up this question as starting right off in Genesis, in fact, right off of the part of Genesis that is our theme for the week, in which Moses speaks to, or God speaks to Moses out of the burning bush. And the sort of, yes, God is interested in place argument is that God chose this place, and because we cannot help but be in places because we're creatures, God is always working in a place, and therefore God is pro-place. The counter argument is that God is not that interested in places. God is interested in people. And when Moses moved on, God moved with Moses, and you know, no one knows where the burning bush was anymore, and whatever was holy and sacred about that ground was sort of temporary and wasn't intrinsic. And I don't personally like that interpretation so much, but it's obviously one that has ascendancy in some parts of Christianity. So I recommend both the book and the thought to you as you both think about what I talk about today, and also then after you leave Holden, sort of think about that argument and what it might mean to you in your daily life. The other book that's in the bookstore, and they urge me to waive these so that they sell them because they ordered them on my recommendation, is The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs. If there's any classic in the field, this is the classic. And it's just a fantastic book. I can't recommend it highly enough either. It's 40 years old now and absolutely as fresh as the day that it was written. If anything more important than the day it was written. It's really about, any Click and Clack fans in the audience?
Yeah.
You know what they say? They say, you know, we're not really talking about cars here, we're talking about people and relationships, and cars are just a vehicle. Anyway, that's sort of, you know, she's talking about cities here, but she's really talking about relationships and how cities support or hinder those relationships. And if you're interested in relationships, which as Christians I hope that we are, then this is a fantastic book to read. I have a couple of others up here which I invite you to look at after the show if you're interested. But those are, I know that there's still copies of those in the bookstore, so check it out if you wish. We have tried to attack a really broad field from a variety of directions this week, and if you go to any bookstore and look in the planning and urban design, et cetera, section, even you know, in the last couple of years, there's been shelves published on this stuff, and these are the routes in that I tried to take, and I like to think that it's been sort of interesting over the course of the week. In any case, now we're down to Friday, and we've been talking, I hope, as we've gone, about what not only what we have done, but also about what we can do. But that's the main topic of today's talk is the alternatives, and then I'm going to talk basically about some stories that I've been a part of as part of suggesting to you what we can and in fact have done that is positive. And I'm going to break this subject down into two questions. How will we know good community design when we see it? And then what is the we in that? Who should decide what constitutes good design? I think that it is fair to say that over the past, 4,000 years of city design, it is a subject that has been largely left to professionals, artists, planners, call them what you will. Over the last 50 years or so, it's been left increasingly to traffic engineers, which I think is sort of unfortunate. It has not generally been the province of the citizens who are going to be affected, with some notable exceptions. Another book which I will recommend to you if you're interested is Architecture Without Architects, which was a brief classic for a while and still is used in a lot of design schools as what happens when people just absolutely get out of the way and let the people do sort of what they want. They typically come up with really beautiful designs in most cases. You think about the sort of the classic Greek white, city that everybody loves to go cruising in the Aegean and take the pictures of. There were no architects typically involved there. The architects worked on a church maybe, but everything else was just people responding to local conditions and working with what they had, and they produced great beauty.
Where is this that you're talking about?
Oh, just your average Greek white, whitewashed
Greek
city. But you could probably fill in, any number of other examples from other cultures if you wish. In any case, not to spin off too much on that subject, but I'm going to talk about stories in which communities grappled with the question of what constitutes good design from our perspective, not from the perspective of some self-appointed expert or some expert that maybe wasn't self-appointed, but we appointed an expert and said, please tell us what kind of city we should have. And then what the methods they used to decide what constituted good design for them. On Monday, we ran through a pile of slides and rated them and talked about them. This was one that scored particularly low, what I asked people to do was to score things in terms of how it made them feel, not whether they thought it was, economically viable or something. But nobody, looked at this and said, gosh, that really makes me feel good, Now, that's your garden variety apartment building. This is really very easy to build in any part of the country you might care to name, where apartment buildings are allowed. In fact, not only is it easy to build, they're going to kind of make you build this because in most parts of the country they want a lot of parking, and this maximizes the amount of parking per apartment unit is to, chuck it into the building like that. Now, another model for apartment buildings is, again, where apartment buildings are allowed, you have the apartments, let's say three stories, but instead of parking underneath it, you have some sort of retail or a deli, as in this case, and the area around it is not hostile to people, but it is inviting to people. And this is very, very difficult to build in most parts of the country for reasons that we went into on Monday. But what concerns me right now is, we may, sitting in this room, say, well, we like this one and we don't like the first one. But, how do we translate that into a city plan? We can't sit around and say, well, we like it or we don't like it. Right, and governments in particular don't run, sometimes they do, but most bureaucracies do not run on a scale of like to don't like. They require, repeatable, objective, measurable kinds of approaches to these kinds of public policy problems. Ditto with some of the even the more engineering or technical style questions that come up in city design. On Wednesday, we talked about the whole day was given over to, was it Wednesday or Tuesday that we talked about relationships? Wednesday, not that people care. We talked about this is your typical suburban kind of hierarchical street plan. This is the kind of typical traditional. If the town was built before 1960 or 50, street plan, and there are any number of reasons why we moved from the one to the other. The thing that concerned me was, and my claim was, that this facilitated relationship in a way that this did not. If you want me to recap that discussion, I can, but let's just take, for the moment, as a given that it's easier to get around and to meet your neighbors, et cetera, in this kind of pattern, and you would prefer this pattern to this one. Now, it's a little bit easier to say technically to a planner or to an engineer, we want this and we don't want this, right? But even there, you know, you may say, well, we want this, but we want, you know, an arterial over here so we can get some of the traffic off the roads. We still have a grid, but we get some of the traffic off to go downtown quickly, et cetera. And, you know, these are not pure forms, right? So pretty soon you have an arterial over here, you have one here, and then it starts looking a little bit like this. How do you distinguish between them technically so that you can tell somebody this is what we want, or, you know, they come to you with a plan and they say, well, how can we tell if that's a good plan? I mean, you know, you say that you've given us a grid plan, but how can we tell? It has a couple of arterials on it, and how do we know it's not this in disguise, right? So once again, we're back to the question of, getting away from, you're telling me that's a good thing, how can I know for myself? And also, if I want it, how can I tell you to give it to me, right? And so here I jump into a couple of the actual stories and finish with the teeing up. This is a job that we did, it started a couple years ago. South Weymouth Naval Air Station is 1,300 acres of closed naval air station just south of Boston. It's 20 minutes south of Boston. In World War II, it was a blimp base. Sort of an interesting history, actually. It had the anti-sub blimps here. And there was an absolutely monstrous hangar that they sold the pictures of. And this is not it. This is a much smaller hangar. You could fit, like, I don't know what they said, a couple of hundred of those hangars inside the hangar that they stored the blimps in that they've since taken down. Anyway, this is what it looks like right now at South Weymouth. And it's 1,300 acres, as I say, south of Boston. The largest single open and continuous development site in all of New England. Not just Boston, but in all of New England. There were a variety of opinions, as you might imagine, on what one should do with this base, which had been closed. And, you know, huge runways, et cetera. It's ringed by a lot of bases, not just because of the blimps, but they used this for jet fighter training more recently. And they wanted a big sort of open buffer space around it. So, you know, there were some proposals to keep that just as open space. Other people said, you know, we've already kind of screwed the environment with these giant runways, let's at least build something there, et cetera. The towns around the base, substantially hostile to any kind of new growth whatsoever. Didn't think that it would benefit, only bring traffic, you know, new kids. This is the new problem with planning is children. God forbid we should have any children. We'd have to educate them. That's very expensive. Sort of another flip from the way things used to be. But anyway, very, very, very contentious process. And they had already been through two plans that had made a certain amount of way through the political process here when we were asked to come in and help break the logjam. And we participated in the development of a variety of different plans. One of the environmental concerns was, in sort of an ironic twist, military bases tend to be fantastic preservers of some types of natural resources because they don't want anyone to go there for security purposes. So all these wetlands still on the base. The runways ran this way and then a crosswind runway this way, and the facilities were kind of clustered here. But anyway, so a lot of wetlands preserved in very nice condition. The very first proposal at the top was for a giant office park. And then we had a variety of sort of mixed use, both work and live proposals, and we won't go through the merits and disadvantages of each of those. But my proposal to you is, that there are towns that surround, there's one town here, a second town here, a third town here, all of which run on New England town meeting rules, which means that every spring they pile into a room and make decisions. And it's sort of the ultimate in pure democracy. A process which makes some people quail, and which other people think is, you know, the way it really should be. But in any case, that is the way it is for these three towns. And the state also very concerned, because if one does put a lot of growth on this 1,300 acres, and 1,300 acres can absorb a lot of growth, you know, there are implications for the state road, which runs over here. Are they in for money? The feds were concerned because these were federal wetlands, et cetera, et cetera. So any number of actors, as you can imagine. The three towns got the ultimate authority, and it would be, I think, difficult enough to convince one town what the right thing to do was, but three, oh my God, you know. And who knows who shows up at those town meetings? There's no way to know. It's not like you're working with the town manager, you know, and if you convince her, then you've made a certain amount of progress. So you can imagine why they got through two plans already and got nowhere, and everyone was like, oh my God, you know, this is terrible. How are we going to decide between these plans? We came in and we said, you know, let's ask the community what they really want. Not what they don't want. They don't want the kids, they don't want the traffic, they don't want the, you know, but what do you want? And then how would you rate it? How would you come up with indicators for what constituted a good plan, a good outcome from your perspective, and what didn't? And both we and another firm that we hired to help us out with this have a list of these kinds of what we call them indicators, but you could call them any number of things, performance standards, et cetera. But indicators of community impact from which communities can choose in these kinds of situations, or they can develop their own, and we help them do that. And I'll just mention a couple to you. Water consumption, for example. The part of Massachusetts south of Boston is running out of fresh water, and they're starting to get seawater incursion because they've pumped all their fresh water out. So that was important. You might be concerned about park space and park proximity to housing. You might be concerned about air pollution emissions because Boston has some problems with that. You might be concerned about proximity to amenities. If you think that one of the things that makes a good community is that you can walk to the grocery store or to the school, and we can, you know, put in whatever amenities you think need to be put in there, et cetera. You might think that getting to transit easily would be good if the traffic congestion in Boston bothers you, and probably it would if you lived there. So you would want to measure how easy it was to get to transit to downtown, et cetera. So you go through these and other kinds of potential indicators, and you work with the community, and you say, before we look at any of the plans, let's agree beforehand what will constitute a good plan for you, right? And then you weight each of these indicators as well. Like, yeah, maybe we're interested in water consumption, we understand that that's important, but that's not ultimately kind of our problem, that's ultimately kind of the problem of, it's not in fact the problem of the state, but let's say you thought that it was, and so you rate that kind of lower. One of our jobs as the outsiders to be able to say to them, in fact, water consumption is your problem, and we think you should weight it a little bit more highly. So there's a little bit of give and take there. But other things are purely their own preference. They can weight park supplies high or low as they care to, right? So you do all of this before the plan, and of course, you know, people being smart are thinking ahead of time, well, the plan that I want is going to score higher on this, so I'm going to have them weight that higher before we go in. But, you know, you can only do so much of that. You can never really 100% tell ahead of time which is going to work better. And so how do we convert those kinds of things into actual numbers that one can score? And I'll give you just a couple of examples. Say that you care about being able to get to a grocery store easily. And so in the in a plan, you may have the grocery store right here, and then it's a very simple thing with computers these days to just measure the distance from that grocery store to each of the individual plots of land where there will be, and again, you can tell the computer whether you only care about walking distance from houses or whether you care about walking distance from everything. You want to be able to walk to the grocery store from your office, for example. So it's a very simple matter to just ask the computer to measure the distance from here, walking distance, you know, to a house. And you'll notice that this is not a simple circle, which is how people used to do it. before computers, but computers being both dumber and also a bit faster than we are, can actually measure the walking distance down the actual street. And so you chuck this in, and you can use this obviously not only as a way to rate plans, but as a way to tweak them as well. If you, these people over here are kind of, you know, out of luck. And so, you know, maybe you don't put in another grocery store, maybe you change the street plan a little bit so there's a more direct pedestrian route to the grocery store, et cetera. But what I'm concerned about right now is just rating the plan. So that's, grocery store, park, whatever. You can measure the walk distance. Another example of that, proximity to transit stops. Here you don't just have the one grocery store, you have transit stops kind of scattered around. And so it's a slightly more complicated measurement, but it's interesting. The reason I popped this one up here is, once again, it's not just the radius, and in planning, people will typically talk about people's willingness to walk 15 minutes or a quarter mile to a transit stop. And so, again, pre-computer, one would just trace out a quarter mile circle around the transit stop. But that, you know, if there's not an actual connection here, that's not really what's happening. And so even though this is a very short distance, here's a very close house, right, very short walk, but this is not an actual connection, although it looks like it here. And this person to walk to this transit stop has to walk all the way around, right? And so that's not transit accessible, and this pops out on this map very easily.
Well, what's the measurement? Is it feet?
It's feet.
Pace of the average human? Feet?
It's a quarter mile walking is the typical willingness to walk to a transit stop. Now, obviously, it's not the case that everybody within the quarter mile is willing to, and, you know, a quarter mile plus one is not. There's a, you know, this person is probably a lot more willing to walk than, you know, these people, right? But there was another hand? No? Okay. So the magic of computers, and these are called geographic information services, services as well. So any one of the indicators, do I have another illustration here of how one translates indicator? No. Any one of those indicators can be translated into something measurable. And so it's not just an expert eyeballing it and saying, looks good to me. What we do is we suggest to people come back and we encourage them, of course, to apply their own judgment, but we also say, you know, based on our professional experience around the country, some measurements constitute good practice and some do not. So, for again, this quarter mile willingness to walk to transit, we know from experience around the country that people are willing to walk a certain distance and not more than that. And so if the average distance to a transit stop is under a quarter mile, actually better if it's, you know, an eighth of a mile, then we say that's good and it's green. Between a quarter and a half, and transit service is actually pretty good, and so people are maybe willing to walk a little further, then it's yellow, and if it's more than that, it's red. And that's based on our national experience. And we can do that for every one of the indicators for which it makes sense to kind of rate them. At the top here, these are all six of the plans that I laid out for you. At the top here are population and business square foot total measurements. And, you know, there's no good or bad there. There's no rating to be applied. It's just a information you would want to have about the plan. So we go through each plan, and we rate each performance in the performance of each indicator in the sort of, you know, we call it the stoplight system for obvious reasons, but red, green, or yellow. And as you can tell, as the plans proceeded, they got better. According to the indicators that the community had chosen. It's not what ICF said was good. It's not what, you know, name your famous planner that you care to name, if you know any, said was good. It's not what the state highway department said was good. It's not even what the state government said was good, which who was going to be building the sewers out here. This is what the community said was good. And the plans got better according to the community's evaluation and input over time, which I think is, you know, first of all, it's the only way forward. Whether or not you think that that's good for other reasons, it was the only way to move forward on this particular question because the three towns kind of had veto power over the base. Next slide here. I'm pleased to, before we move to the next one, this, and I apologize if you've been here before, we can't go backwards using the remote, so I have to go backwards by hand. Sorry. I'm pleased to tell you that just 2 weeks ago, all three towns voted to approve the most green plan. And so this base redevelopment is going to go forward. They have a master developer who is behind the principles of mixed use and transit accessibility and preserving the wetlands. They've signed an agreement with the Navy, and things are moving forward. So it's a huge success story, and I'm very proud of it. You know, not that I did the planning necessarily. I just, my firm's big contribution was this rating system into and helping the community develop buy-in into the evaluation of the plans, and then other people were actually doing the planning and reacting to the scores. But I think it's a powerful tool that really gets to the best of community participation in planning. Yes.
So you were just using national best practice averages to establish the red, green, whatever, or were you using community tolerance?
No, that was just national best practice. And so that's an excellent point. I mean, the community could say, well, let's develop the stoplight system according to our values, and you could certainly do that. That would
should
be
add years more to the consulting problems.
Well, and wouldn't that be a shame? No? Any other before we go on to the next story?
What are the unfavorables, of which there are only three on the last plan, but they were consistent?
Yeah. The first is, let me carry it across, single family dwelling share and multifamily dwelling share. And this is an outcome, remember this was the community developing its preferences, right? And they maintained an antipathy toward new school age families to the end. And the developer is going to actually build a school on the site so that they, the existing school system will not bear the as much of a brunt of new kids. But it was very clear to the developer, who, as I said, is fairly enlightened, not that they produced a very good plan at the beginning, but fairly enlightened, he said, you know, we really want to have a genuine community here, and that means kids. And so they were unwilling to have, you know, the town's original idea was only retirement community, basically. They weren't very happy with the new families. And then the other one was, external street connectivity. And if you were here on Wednesday when we went through the street connectivity stuff, I'll go back one step again. You don't want, even if you have good internal in your town sort of connectivity, you also want good connection to other places. Because otherwise, everybody, even if they're taking transit, but everyone who drives, and many people will continue to drive, are all going to pour out this road in the morning, right? Or pour out this road, and there's going to be a terrible traffic jam right here. And none of the plans really address that, and there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is that there are wetlands that you don't want to pave over to provide more external connectivity. One of them was, there was actually, before this crosswind runway was built, there was a street that went here, which was a reasonably important street, and we wanted to reconnect that. And the towns were adamantly opposed to that. They're like, you know, it was so quiet after they closed the street, it was magnificent, you know? And these property owners on either side of this were like, over our dead bodies, and so that's not gonna happen. So, you know, the score, it worked. It reflected the fact that this is not a good plan from that perspective.
Will?
Yes.
What are the three neighboring towns to Weymouth?
It's Weymouth, Abington, and Rockland. They each have their own politics and etc. Okay, well, so that's one story. I won't spend all day on the one story. This is the Burlington, Vermont Fairgrounds story. And Burlington, even though it's quite a progressive place, has not escaped the influences of the rest of the nation, and has sprawled such that it has engulfed its previously out in the country state fairgrounds. And so the fairgrounds are now surrounded by a neighborhood and didn't function so well as fairgrounds anymore for a variety of reasons. And so the fairgrounds are removed further out, and there was going to be a new neighborhood put in here. And so here are the two alternatives, and the city was on board with the kind of model which I just presented to you, where you develop alternatives. You don't just do automatically the straight cul-de-sac, standard suburban development. So they had this alternative, and then they had the mixed use and more connected both internally and externally, and some parkland, and et cetera. Same question, how do you really tell that one is better than the other instead of, well, we just like this because it's the flavor of the month thing. And Will Schroer's an expert, and he told us it was better. So we did the exact same thing, go through the rating, et cetera, and weighted everything and came up with a composite score, which we didn't do in the first one. Putting in the standard sort of cul-de-sac-y development actually made things worse. We rated the whole neighborhood, not just the standalone development, but its impact on the whole neighborhood. It's actually made things worse, which was a real kind of slap upside the head to people, even people that kind of liked the smart growth, more connected development. It was hard for people to believe that putting the traditional thing in would actually make things worse. Okay, maybe it wouldn't make them better, but to make it worse, according to the values that they had themselves expressed. The alternative proposal made things better. They chose the other one as well. Now, the second point that I'd like to make with this story is that if you can use these kinds of indicators to choose between plans, you can also use them to track progress towards some desired end states. Now, back in South Weymouth, Carol points out, Carol points out, hey, you've still got some red stuff there. Maybe you can't fix that immediately, but wouldn't you like to set some long-term goals of those are all green, or maybe even some even higher goals over time to reach, I don't know what the color would be, but gold or something, right? So that's exactly what they did here, and they divided it up into development phases. This is the first phase that scored pretty well, and these are, again, they didn't establish goals, but they looked at improving their scores over time through the first phase and then redeveloping some of the other neighborhoods in the second phase, and things got even better. And so what one can use indicators for is watering the street. That would be a good thing to honk for. You can track progress towards goals over time. Another word for it, track implementation. Right? And whether there's phasing or not, you can imagine saying to a developer, or the developer says to you, I can't commit to this plan right now because the market is always changing. Today people want single family, maybe tomorrow they want apartments, maybe the day after that they want even more retail and less residences. And the neighbors can say, that's fine, we're not going to tell you exactly what plan to use, or we're not going to make you submit the final plan right now. We're going to tell you, you got to reach here, on most of your indicators, whatever plan you choose. And these are the criteria. And we're not going to tell you how to meet them. That's your business. Then you can adapt to trends as they come and go. But you got to reach at least this far. And so you track implementation in that way. And that's a powerful tool. So who should decide what constitutes good community design? You should. And how should you decide between alternative plans? This isn't the only way. It's the way that I and my company use, and we find that it works, and we, beyond finding that it works, just philosophically like the idea that the people around the table are the citizens and not just the professionals of whoever the professionals are. And that's gratifying to me personally, and I think it's in line with any community should be about. That's 40 minutes. We can do a couple of things at this point. I thought it might be kind of nice to talk about Holden as a model or not a model for these kinds of things. I think that people have the tendency to look at someplace like Holden, where they spend eye-popping amounts of money to fly to Europe and enjoy those cities, but we can't do that in our community. For whatever reason, and I think that we can, and I think that communities have done it successfully. But so we could talk about this. I also have a couple of other sort of stories or points that I could make. I'd prefer to sit and talk, but if you'd like to hear sort of more stories, we can do that. Yes, Nancy?
Who hires you? Did the township, like the Weymouth thing?
No, the feds.
Because they own it. So
yes.
Basically, who generally hires you when you come in to consult on property like that? The owner of the property?
Typically, the feds hire us for one reason or another. My firm has, the Environmental Protection Agency likes to let out big multi-year contracts so they don't have to compete every little kind of piece of work that they do. And we have the big multi-year support contract to EPA's Smart Growth Program. And they get any number of requests for assistance from towns that have whatever kind of growth problem, or from other federal agencies for that matter, like you know the Air Force, or like the Navy in this case, or the state of Massachusetts. The state did not want that first plan. They were like terrified of that first plan. It didn't make it through the townships anyway, but the state and the Navy both kind of asked EPA to help them out. I was talking with Suzanne at dinner about a local technical assistance program that EPA runs, where the town can just apply for help managing their growth to EPA, and we provide that technical assistance as well. We don't work only for the feds, but that's our biggest customer.
So, I mean, it seems to be the process that you offer people is a really good one. So, like, if you're in a city and you've got a big log jam on some piece of property, we had one near us recently, you know, is it legitimate for an average citizen to just say, we think you should hire some planners here that will help you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Consultants.
Well, there are also consulting firms that just specialize in running that kind of a community meeting.
Okay, yeah.
To help you figure out what decision you want to make.
Yeah. There's a multifold challenge with those sorts of things. The first is to get the community to agree. The second is to then get the official part of the community to agree to act on that plan. And to people don't like to, you know, in this case, the three towns said, you know, we'll participate in this process, and we'll rate your plans, you know, et cetera, but we're not agreeing to adopt, you know, whatever plan turns out best. We'll either pass it or not pass it as we feel like at our town meeting. And, you know, because they weren't paying for the process, they could maintain that kind of blasé attitude towards it. It's another thing to get the town to pay for a process but at the same time say, well, we may not use this outcome. But then getting them to commit to use the outcome is also difficult because they're not 100% sure where it's going to go. So, you know, I think it's a great process. I'm glad to think that you do as well, but it's not always the easiest possible, so. Well, let's talk about Holden then for a minute. Or Maria, you're looking quizzical?
No.
No? All right, good. What is it about Holden that you like? That makes you think that this is, maybe you don't think that it's a good community, but let's assume for the moment that you've come all the way up here because you think it is. What about it, and you don't have to constrain yourself at all to the physical aspects, but although I will try and steer the conversation back then to whether the physical design has an effect on what you like about the community, but you can mention any aspect of it. Let's just throw it out.
Communal dining.
Communal dining.
The town square, the arc. People just collect there, it's great.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I like the visibility of the infrastructure.
Would you like to say more about that?
I mean, just we know where our electricity comes from, we know where our water comes from, we know where our garbage goes. All the things that it takes to sustain human life are visible to us here. We know the packaging we have to get rid of, at least those of us who volunteer for garbology, always a good idea. So it makes me realize the human impact on the environment by the way that it's structured.
Yeah. Let me stop this. I guess one thing we could do is I could pull up the screen and I could write all this stuff down, then we could go, you know, in that order. But let me just mention a couple of things at this point. The technical term for what you just mentioned about the visibility of the infrastructure is, in a project unit anyway, legibility.
Oh.
That when you look at it, you get it. Right, and you don't have to have a degree to get it, or you don't have to go on a tour to get it, or you don't have to, right? And another book that I did not bring, but which is a classic in the field, is called The Image of the City by Kevin Lynch, written in the 50s even. You know, one of the things that strikes me here is the subtitle of the Jacobson book, if you remember, is Sidewalks in the Kingdom, New Urbanism and the Christian Faith. And this is one of the labels for what I'm selling people is New Urbanism. And then, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer. We tend to call it New Urbanism because Americans have this thing for the new. But it's old urbanism, right? And much of the seminal thinking in this area, certainly older towns exhibit it, but the understanding of what makes them good, you know, it's 50 and 60 and 100 and 200 years old. Anyway, Kevin Lynch in The Image of the City did a fascinating thing, which I encourage you as sort of a fun parlor game maybe sometime to do, is he asked people to draw him a map of various parts of the town in which they lived, right? And the one that comes immediately to mind because it was the most famous part was Boston. And people would, you know, draw maps of Boston. Here's the State House, here's the Boston Common, you know, the thing and make way for ducklings. And over here is Back Bay where I go shopping, etc. And he asked, you know, I don't know, a couple hundred people do this, some statistically significant sample, kind of aggregated the maps. And, you know, you compare the actual map of Boston and then people's mental map of Boston, and it's just fascinating. Because whole chunks of Boston, nowhere on these maps. They don't show up, you know? And it's not that people don't go there, but if you do go there, you can tell why they're not on people's maps. And in fact, people don't go there unless they have to. They are not legible to people. Lynch, from there, developed some theories of what constitutes a legible city and one that people are comfortable in. And, you know, why do people go to Beacon Hill and the State House and Boston Common and Back Bay? It's not just because they're attractive, although they are, but they also know how to get there. And when they're there, they know where they are. And people like to know where they are. They feel comfortable when they know where they are. And I think Holden exhibits that in spades. Now, it's a pretty small place, so it would be a little bit difficult to build Holden in a way that you wouldn't know where you were when you were, you know, in it. But I don't think it's impossible, and I could think of some planners that if you gave them the job, they could jolly well come up with a plan where you'd be hopelessly lost even within a couple hundred yards. Yes.
The opposite example of that is a casino, where I'm positive that
absolutely.
They design it so that you get lost and can't find the doors and can't
find
the windows.
That's so true. One of the things that we I'm going to pick up on your other, I don't know if it was the second theme or what, but about the outdoor living room and the Ark, and people just love to be there. And it's in part because you know where you are, and it's in part because it's a crossroads, it's a town square. But it is also in part, Warren's not here, but I'll blame him for, he came to me, it was very kind of him actually, and I have to tell him this privately as well as publicly, but said, you know, I went to your to Monday session and we had a whole bunch of slides, and one of the slides, in which I can throw up here actually, I should do that, showed a sort of a very low density strip, you know, just one story buildings along a street, and then the same street, we'd increase the building height on each side to four stories. And everybody liked that slide once it was four stories, and we talked about how people like the feeling of enclosure. They like to feel like they're in a room, whether they're in a room or whether they're outside. And if you're outside, you would like to feel that you're in an outside room. And given the width of the street, one story was not enough on either side of the street to provide that sense of enclosure. You needed four stories to provide the sense of enclosure so that you felt like you were in a comfortable, protected outside room. And so Warren said to me, you know, I've been against this proposed development at 50th and France because they're going to shoot these buildings up a couple more stories. This is a neighborhood in our neighborhood. And he said, now I understand that one of the advantages to putting the higher heights on the buildings, and now I have to look at it with a whole new eye. So I was really gratified by him telling me that. You know, there are other reasons to do that as well. It makes it more economically viable. You have to develop a critical mass of people, and you know, people like to go where other people are, and there are any number of reasons to do that. But one of the reasons is that you develop this outside room feeling, and people love that. So that's, Holden is doing a great job of that, whether on purpose or not. You know, the communal dining, I think that goes to people like to go where other people are. On Wednesday, we talked about this this mania for trying to increase throughput, either on roads or, you know, even not on roads in any kind of facility. There's a certain amount of understanding now, I think, in the profession that a certain amount of congestion is good. What does it say when, put aside highways for a moment, what does it say when the sidewalk is crowded, when the store is crowded, when the restaurant is crowded? It's a great place to be. People want to be there. And the crowding begets more crowding. And, you know, no restaurateur in his right mind has ever said, you know, if we can only get some of these people out of here, right? It's an indicator of success, not of failure, to have a certain amount of human congestion, because people like other people. They like to be where other people are. You see that at the ARC. And I think that the communal dining, you know, you're not going to have, except in some circumstances, genuinely communal dining in a city, you know, environment. But you will have these districts where everybody, you know, all the restaurants have tables out on the street, you know, the town square kind of thing, and people love that. They just love it. And it's something that can be created, again, with an eye toward the right design details. What else do we like about Holden? Maria?
Well, the density of where people live is in close proximity to the dining hall, the ARC, not too far from the village center point of view. I mean, it's all kind of laid out to give a kind of an ease of, it's easy to get to places.
Yes.
But then there's a balance with some privacy in like the chalets and Narnia being a little bit farther out.
Now, one could imagine, you know, not that the mining company would do this, but let's say we're designing this place from scratch and somebody said, it's a retreat center and people are going up there for rest and renewal. You know, let's max out the privacy and the quiet, and we just, you know, blew the whole thing up. And everything was a lot further away from each other. Effect?
You'd have to walk miles to get to the wilderness.
And, well, A, excellent point. Excellent point. I'm not paying her to say this stuff, really. And then its effect on communal life?
Less community, more in those relevant.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, the design just makes a huge impact on what kind of community you are going to have. Now, again, the community may be decided. We're more about the individuality, we're more about the solitude than you design for that. But it is not the case that one can say that it is the people that make all the difference. The design is an equal partner. The standard quote that people like to throw up at this point is Winston Churchill, first we shape our buildings and then they shape us. And I don't think anyone's improved on that for pithiness. Yes?
And talking about shaping our buildings and, you know, the congestion within our sleeping facilities, and we're all using one bathroom. The genius was putting a sink in each room. Because we go back and forth and we use the bathroom, that's okay, wash your hands. But you know, if you want to brush your teeth or you're getting ready for bed, it's just a quick moment down, and then you have the privacy of your room. But the sink was a genius. The sink was a genius in each room.
And if I may then extrapolate to it some sort of broader principle, yeah, you know, not all congestion is good, not all community acting, you don't want to do everything together. And then so the role of good design is to decide which is which, what do you provide for individually, what do you provide for communally. Exactly. Don?
The only downside I encountered is there's no override button on the emergency alarm system. Once you've got control of the matter, you don't need that horn anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Maria, no, you, and then we'll come back to Maria. But you have one.
This sort of, it's one thing that Holden has, but it also applies to development. It is sort of touching on what they were saying. If you broke it out into, say, cabins with a little yard, and circumscribed the area, and said, okay, this is it. This is all you have. It's much nicer to have it dense in one area and common open space.
Yes.
That's usable by everyone.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. I can't improve on that, but I'll just take this as an excuse to mention something which happened last night, which I think goes a little bit to this theme. So the Dining Community Lutheran Church crowd was over on our porch yucking it up last night. this little girl from the chalet next door opens her window and says, "Would you please be quiet?" We all felt pretty sort of shamefaced. You know, and that's the sort of thing which I think that, you know, that happens a couple of times. You get out of Holden now for a moment, you're back in your neighborhood, and you're like, hey, you know, I paid a lot of money for this house, and by golly, if I want to have a party, I'm going to have a party. And, you know, if that happens five or six times, you're like, you know, maybe we need to move to another neighborhood where we have a little more privacy. I'm not suggesting that's an inappropriate decision or not, but, you know, what do you lose by that? I think there's a community feel which comes from the 8-year-old girl next door saying, "Would you please be quiet?" You know, and you have to think a little bit more about, I'm a member of a community, and I have to kind of organize my life accordingly. And I kind of like that, actually. I'll just share one quick more story and then get back. But one of my colleagues sent around a piece from the New York Times recently, which purported to evaluate the progress of new urbanism in communities around the country. And one of the quotes from a homeowner was, you know, they looked at a new urbanist community and they decided not to buy there. And she said, you know, I don't want to spend $500,000 on a teacup house. And this was a new term for me. Does anyone know what a teacup house is? It's a house where you can lean out with a teacup and ask for a cup of sugar from a man. Having just bought a teacup house, I took a little bit of umbrage at the idea that this would be a bad idea. I think that the idea is that we should have communities where if you want that, then you should be able to buy it. And the only thing that we are building in a lot of parts of the country is the house with a lot of space in between it. And if that's what you want, I think that that's fine. We should have the choice to have to live in a more compact neighborhood if that's what you want.
Speaking of, along those lines, one of the things that always fascinated me is that when I grew up in St. Louis, our neighbor had on the back of their lot, which was kind of long, 150 feet long, a little two-bedroom house.
Mm-hmm.
Had a little screened-in porch.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And that's where the little old lady and the little old man lived.
Absolutely.
That had no other place to go.
Yeah.
They could afford that.
Yeah.
And came out here, and one of my very good friends at work moved over to Bellevue from Beacon Hill, where he'd grown up. Then, many years later, his mother had to sell a family home, and they wanted a little place for her over in Bellevue. Mm-hmm. Forget it.
It's illegal.
No.
There was no little place.
Right.
Well, not only that, it's illegal to have a second.
It's
illegal. A lot of places to build
even
a second.
Even more along the line with
detached housing unit on the same piece of property.
Right. Sad.
It is.
Sad.
I agree.
Just a local observation. Mm-hmm. I spent quite a bit of time yesterday down in Lucerne,
mm-hmm.
and was marveling at all these little tiny cabins where individual families were living 6 or 7 feet from each other, but they were all very individual, and yet they were compacted into an area about this size. And just looking at the way these two very close communities were externally structured, certainly must impact the way people relate to each other.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Maria?
Well, I guess when you first asked the question, what I thought came to my mind was an intangible, but I think it translates into what I thought was this physical, in what appeals to me physically about home, and that is, I mean, this is a very intentional community. And so people are intentional about living in community. And there's a community in Seattle that strikes me as being similar, and that's the New Holly development. And we have some friends that are pastors of the UCC church, and they have chosen to live there. And so we go there regularly for a book group. But it's wonderful to see the fact that they created mixed income and mixed mm-hmm. condominium and houses, mm-hmm. and then building in a community center and play space.
Right.
What a wonderful diverse neighborhood they created.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry? I'm going to mention one last thing and then give people the permission to leave if they like. And then I'm going to, if we have any diehards in the audience, I have a sort of unconnected set of shots which I would like to share, if, again, if people are interested, from a development outside of Portland called Fairview Village. Anyone familiar with that? This is a developer got a whole town-sized plot of land and really wanted to go to town on developing according to these smart growth principles. And I thought it just did a fantastic job. Has granny flats over the garage, has live work units, has all the stuff that we used to have. He was able to do this because he was able to buy basically kind of a whole town at once. Now, developers routinely do that and buy, you know, multi-hundred acre plots of land and don't do that. So I just wanted to share this if people were interested. But let me make one last point about Holden, which I think is absolutely key, and which none of you have mentioned yet, which is the porches. And to put aside the art for a moment, people just love to gather on those porches. And they're, you know, you're not going to have, unless you live in an apartment building, but quite the experience of going in through the porch, right, and seeing people every day in your home. But we used to have the experience of going by on the sidewalk and seeing who was out on the porch and stopping and chatting. And there was this whole sort of interesting etiquette about it. You have to be asked to come up, you know, two or three times, and then, you know, you weren't being actually asked into the house, but, you know, et cetera. I thought it was a nice thing. And we don't build the houses with the front porches anymore for a variety of reasons, one of which I think has to do with the increase in traffic in front of the house, and so everything moved to the back. But porches still work where they're built, even though people don't walk by it quite as much as they used to. And in neighborhoods where porches are intentionally built, we still see that they work to develop community and neighborhood.
Along that very line, my oldest son moved down to Asuncion, Paraguay. And after he got there, he had a little place to live, and he found out that he was getting to all of his assignments late. And it took him a while to figure it out, but the problem was, the custom was that as you leave your house and go out of the community, you are expected to visit. You can't leave the barrio without politely visiting.
Right.
And he said, it was killing me. He's going to leave the home early.
That's it. Suzanne.
By extension of the front porches, Holden is the ultimate in pedestrian friendly. I mean, there's no cars, and if we had cars, then we'd have garage doors instead of porches. Interaction would be very different.
Okay, well, that's 7:20. I don't want to keep people, so feel free to leave. I'm going to throw up just a few shots of this Fairview Village, just because I think he did such a fantastic job. People usually like seeing them, so I'm just going to do that. But as I say, feel free to leave. And thank you for coming. If you want to look at any of the books on your way out, do that as well. I'm just going to switch shows very quickly.